From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, we talk with writer and editor David Remnick about his new book, King of the World. It describes how Ali became a great boxer, great showman, and outspoken Muslim, how he took the country by surprise with his rhymes and his politics, and the price he paid for being so outspoken. We'll also talk with Remnick about his recent appointment as editor of The New Yorker magazine. And rock historian Ed Ward concludes his series on how country music was influenced by black and white music traditions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Hurricane Mitch has stalled off the coast of Honduras and soaking the region with heavy rain. Mitch has weakened somewhat. It's dropped from a Category 5 to a Category 3 hurricane with winds of 120 miles per hour. But forecaster Jeremy Pennington warns Mitch is still treacherous.
Any hurricane is a dangerous hurricane, but a Category 3 is even more so. So even though it's doesn't have the 180-mile-per-hour winds that it had a day or so ago, it still has 120-mile-per-hour winds and can still cause a lot of damage.
At least a dozen fatalities are blamed on the storm, including that of one American. There is also extensive damage. In Honduras, authorities say many towns are cut off by about 50 flooded rivers. Former Chilean leader Augusto Pinochet has won his battle in London's High Court to overturn his arrest 12 days ago by British authorities. From London, Tim Franks reports.
The Lord Chief Justice, Thomas Bingham, ruled that Augusto Pinochet was unlawfully arrested in his hospital bed. Lord Bingham said that General Pinochet, as a former head of state, was entitled to immunity from civil and criminal proceedings in an English court. But the former Chilean leader will not be allowed to go free yet. He'll remain under detention as an appeal is anticipated from the Spanish magistrate who initially asked for his extradition. The arrest of General Pinochet has provoked sharp disagreements between Britain and Chile and also between politicians in Britain itself. As the High Court judgment was being announced, the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, told Parliament that opposition Conservative claims that his government had handled the matter in a crass way were misguided and wrong.
Tim Franks reporting. NASA says the countdown to tomorrow's launch of the space shuttle Discovery is going well. U.S. Senator John Glenn and his six crewmates today will train on board NASA's T-38 training jets. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE has this report.
Space shuttle crews fly in training jets to keep their landing skills sharp before liftoff. Once John Glenn and his crewmates finish 9 days in orbit, they'll have one chance to glide safely down to the ground without engine power. Former NASA astronaut Brian O'Connor has piloted the space shuttle twice. He says the landing is often the trickiest part of any space flight.
It's a unique approach. You can see that runway from about 40, 50,000 feet, almost directly down below you. And you kind of do a dive-bombing run to get back down into the final approach.
200,000 to 300,000 people are expected to squeeze into viewing sites surrounding the space shuttle's seaside launch pad. Liftoff is set for tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 30 points at 8,396. The NASDAQ is up 9 at 1,726. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, after opening lower, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has clawed its way into positive territory. Stocks remain fairly volatile at midweek. NPR's business correspondent Jack Spear reports.
After worrying over details of the plan to bail out Brazil, then deciding recent actions taken by that country's leaders have lessened the likelihood of global recession, Wall Street is modestly higher now. The market is also worrying over earnings and some new government economic numbers today. On the earnings front, cosmetics maker Revlon says third-quarter profits fell by 61% to $12.7 million. The company blames inventory reductions by retailers and a softer demand for its products overseas. Business and furniture supply chain Office Max says its fiscal third-quarter sales were up, though the company warned its earnings may not match market expectations. And drugstore chain CVS says its third-quarter profits rose 24.6% to $102 million. As for durable goods orders, the government says they rose, a stronger-than-expected 0.9% last month. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Officials at Lands' End, the catalog retailer, announced that the president and chief executive officer, Michael Smith, and the chairman of sales, William Ferry, have resigned. The company says David Dyer will replace Smith, but a replacement has not been named yet for Ferry. Toys R Us has launched a mail-order business. The world's largest retailer of kids' items is hoping to boost its sagging sales by giving consumers a new way to shop. The company also sent out its first catalog earlier this month, and another one is on the way this week. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up more than 30 points at 8,396. The Nasdaq is up more than 9 at 1,726. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Cassius, can I ask you how you're feeling now at this point in the
day? I'm feeling great. I'm ready to go to war right now.
Well, when you say you're ready to go to war right
now, I see that barrel in the street. I beat him before the fight.
You'd actually take him on before the fight?
Beat him like I'm his daddy.
I saw somebody listed a few days ago, Cassius.
Ain't he ugly? He's too ugly to be the world champ. The world champ should be pretty like me.
Well, he told me to bet my life that you wouldn't go three rounds.
Well, if you want to lose your money, then bet on money.
May I ask you this?
I'll never lose a fight. It's impossible, tell him. It's impossible.
Never lost a fight in your life.
That's any of my fans during the last time they lost. I'm too fast.
Champion from
the
crib.
I'm the king.
Born
the champ.
Born a champ from the crib.
I'm not only a fighter. I'm a poet. I'm a prophet. I'm the resurrector. I'm the savior of the boxing world. If it wasn't for me, the game would be dead.
That was Cassius Clay in 1964, shortly before he won the world heavyweight title by defeating Sonny Liston. Soon after, Clay took on a new name, Muhammad Ali, and he became famous not just for his rhymes and his abilities in the ring, but for his religion and his politics. Although his outspokenness initially alienated many Americans in the mainstream, Ali became a beloved American hero. David Remnick has written a new book about Ali in the 60s called King of the World. Remnick began his career as a sports writer for the Washington Post. He became the Post Moscow correspondent and went on to write about Russia and other subjects for the New Yorker. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his book Lenin's Tomb. Over the summer, he became the new editor of the New Yorker magazine, replacing Tina Brown. I asked David Remnick why he wanted to write about Ali.
You know, I wanted to write a story that was distinctly American. Having written a couple of books about Russia and having immersed myself in foreign affairs and foreign reporting for so long, I really wanted to write, first and foremost, a story about the United States at a particular time. And in Muhammad Ali, and in not writing a full-length biography, but rather about writing about the early 60s, I discovered that I could write about race in a kind of unexpected narrative-driven way that usually I've been lost at. You know, with these Russia books, they're big, baggy monsters. There's no clear narrative going on. And with Muhammad Ali and the story of his becoming, the way he became champion, the way he became a folk legend, I discovered a story in a particular period of time that excited me on all levels, as narrative, as politics, as race, still our most important American conversation. All these things on the shoulders of, I think, the most electric personality of my time anyway.
You say that Ali entered the world of boxing at a time when the expectation was that a black fighter would behave with absolute deference to white sensibilities. Give me an example of what you mean there.
Well, the champion at the time when Muhammad Ali, then Cassius Clay, was in the Olympics, he was then a light heavyweight in the 1960 Rome Olympics, was Floyd Patterson. And Floyd Patterson was certainly no era-shaking fighter. He was not Joe Louis by any stretch of the imagination, but he imitated Joe Louis as a social type for reasons of being accepted by the white world, by white columnists like Jimmy Cannon or Red Smith. And Patterson was a champion for a very brief time before he was utterly destroyed in the ring twice by Sonny Liston, who was a different type, who was somebody who was a destroyer who was in his time was a fighter not unlike Mike Tyson and a personality not unlike Mike Tyson, a kind of an extremely scary figure to everyone. The NAACP endorsed Floyd Patterson before his fight with Sonny Liston because they were so terrified that Sonny Liston would come along and occupy this place in the American culture, which really only accepted black men as athletes. And it would be bad for the race, essentially. But lo and behold, Sonny Liston was the superior fighter and beat Floyd Patterson twice, both times in the first round.
Well, Ali, when you interviewed him, told you that he wanted to be a new kind of black man when he became famous as a fighter. How do you see him fitting in as a new kind of black man in the world of boxing?
Well, he was what's still called a race man. Not that Liston or Patterson weren't necessarily, but he was, in a new and surprising way, he represented a generational shift that took whites and middle-class blacks as well by surprise. He was the forerunner to the Black Power movement. He was the forerunner to the draft resistance movement. He came along at a time when these sort of things were unknown to whites. He grew up in a household in which his father was a fairly humble sign painter in Louisville, Kentucky. And his father was deeply influenced, as were many blacks throughout the country in the 20s, 30s, and thereafter, by Marcus Garvey, black nationalism of a kind that whites had no clue about. And by the time he, even before he was fighting, he was filled with this notion of what a black man, what a black woman, what anyone in segregated Louisville had to live through and suffer, and he would have none of it.
Well, before he became politicized and before he joined the Nation of Islam, he became known for his really flamboyant style of showmanship and particularly for his great rhyming. And what insights did you get about how he developed that showmanship and the verbal flamboyance?
It began at the beginning. He had his first fight when he was 12 years old. Another kid had stolen his bicycle, and little Cassius Clay was very angry. And he went down to a basement gym run by a cop in town named Joe Martin. And Joe Martin said, "Stop being so angry and stop threatening to beat everybody up, and why don't you learn how to fight?" And so Cassius Clay learned how to fight and put on gigantic gloves. He was a little skinny kid. And he fought one of those sort of church basement type fights. And he won a split decision, 12 years old, 98 pounds. And his reaction afterwards was, "I am the greatest. I will be champion of the world. I am the greatest." The rhetoric that you would hear years and years later, and you would think he invented it last week, it came out of his mouth after a split decision against another 12-year-old.
What was Sonny Liston's reaction to Ali's kind of playful but also aggressive verbal showmanship before their first championship bout together?
Fury and confusion. Sonny Liston was a very simple man, intellectually limited, emotionally limited, and this drove him crazy. He was a great and powerful fighter. He thought he would have no trouble with this guy who fought like Sugar Ray Robinson. He danced around the ring, which, you know, was a bit fey for a heavyweight after all. And Cassius Clay, who was fearful of Sonny Liston in his heart because he knew how powerful he was, he had seen what he had done to Floyd Patterson, wanted to find a way to get to his mind, to unnerve him, to scare him, to make him second guess, to think really that he was crazy, because the one thing that Sonny Liston couldn't deal with was somebody who was nuts. Always in prison, where Sonny Liston had spent some time, the person you never dealt with, the person you always avoided, was the crazy man. That's what you avoided. And so, and Cassius Clay knew that. I'm calling him Clay now because that's who he was at the time. And Clay did things like, you know, drive his bus to Sonny Liston's house in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning, run up to the door and start pounding on the door, screaming and yelling and acting like an insane person. And Sonny Liston would come out on the lawn in his shorty bathrobe, not knowing what to make of this guy. And it really unnerved him. And Clay and then Ali did it over and over and over again. And the one thing Sonny Liston couldn't deal with was a madman.
Of course.
But for Clay, of course, it was all by design. And the most famous instance of it was the weigh-in before the first fight. The weigh-in, Cassius Clay comes in and starts screaming and yelling. Usually these are routine performances in which you really don't do anything other than get weighed and flex your muscles and get the hell out of there. All he's screaming and yelling, I'm going to destroy him, and he's jumping at Liston, and his pulse rate is up to God knows what it was, hundreds and hundreds above of what it should have been. And then an hour later, after it was over, he was absolutely normal and took a nap. It was the most amazing performance, and Sonny Liston went into that ring thinking he was dealing with a nut.
It's a very wrestling kind of attitude to have, that type of showmanship.
Well, it's funny you should say that. One of the influences on his showmanship was Gorgeous George, who was the Hulk Hogan of his time. Gorgeous George, a professional wrestler who wore his long blonde tresses down past his shoulder blades, who sprayed himself with eau de cologne before going in the ring, who caused everyone to hate him, also knew how to fill an arena. And before one of his minor fights, before the championship fights, Clay went and saw Gorgeous George. He was on a radio show with him, and he learned from Gorgeous George. Now, he didn't imitate Gorgeous George. He got all this rhetoric from the dozens, playing the dozens on the street, from his father, who was a braggart, from Marcus Garvey, from the air, from God knows what. But he had an amazing ability, Muhammad Ali did, of assimilating influences that were in the air and making them his own.
My guest is David Remnick. His new book about Muhammad Ali is called King of the World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Remnick, the new editor of The New Yorker. He's written a lot about Russia and the former Soviet Union. His new book is called King of the World, and it's a book about Muhammad Ali. How was Ali introduced to Islam?
It's strange. We think he was influenced when he first went down to Miami and basically met some street guys who were selling Nation of Islam newspapers. Not so. When he was an amateur fighter, still in high school, he would go in a station wagon with some other amateurs from Louisville and fight in regional fights. And one time he was up in Chicago. At that time, the Nation of Islam was completely centered in Chicago. Elijah Muhammad lived there. And as a kid, he was wandering around on the street, and he was given a copy of Muhammad Speaks, and he also bought a record album of Elijah Muhammad's rhetoric, his sermons, essentially. And he brought these home, and he was completely taken up by it. Clearly, this was a searching kid, not an intellectual powerhouse, not a master of his schoolwork, but a searching mind, someone deeply troubled by the segregated place where he grew up with, deeply troubled by the fact that his father was a sign painter who really believed he should have been an artist and was held down. And these things influenced him, and he, for his senior paper, in his senior year of high school, he wanted to write a paper on the Nation of Islam. Well, no one had hardly heard of the Nation of Islam in Louisville. And the teacher said, no, you can't write about this strange and ultimately threatening thing. So there was the seed of it. And then, of course, it blossomed when he became a professional fighter after the Olympics and started meeting with Muslims and Muslim teachers in Miami.
You say that when he became a member of the Nation of Islam, that Elijah Muhammad was ambivalent about Cassius Clay and ambivalent about boxing in general. What was that ambivalence about?
He was ambivalent about boxing because he thought, not unreasonably, that the history of boxing in the United States especially, is rooted in slavery. It's rooted in the spectacle of strong black men made to fight each other for the amusement of whites. And Elijah Muhammad was, for obvious reasons, all against that. On the other hand, although he saw Elijah Muhammad as the spiritual father of the movement, the person he was closest to was Malcolm X. Malcolm X was not bothered much by boxing. In fact, Malcolm X was a pretty good athlete growing up. He liked these things. And so he was able to sort of dance the dance for a while. And Malcolm X was extremely close with Clay and was down in Miami with him leading up to that first dramatic fight with Liston. They both stayed at the Hampton Court Hotel. And Malcolm was there as Clay's guest with his wife. And they became extremely close. It was the formative relationship where politics and where religion was concerned prior to Cassius Clay becoming Muhammad Ali. But then the story turns.
Yeah, well, Ali kind of got in the middle of the dispute between Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X.
Exactly. And Malcolm X's dispute with Elijah Muhammad had to do with a number of things, including the fact that Elijah Muhammad had fathered children outside of his marriage, which Malcolm X subjected to, financial irregularities, the fact that Malcolm X thought that Elijah Muhammad was putting himself far too forward despite his leadership of the movement. And they split in the most dramatic way possible just before this fight. And Malcolm X went down to Miami as much for a vacation, a psychic vacation for himself. No, until then, by the way, no one really knew that Cassius Clay was, in effect, a member of the Nation of Islam. He knew very well, was very sophisticated about this, that if he announced that he was an adherent to the Nation of Islam before the title fight, the fight would never happen. And in fact, the promoter of the fight, Bill McDonald, did find out, because there were some press leaks, and he threatened to call the whole fight off, and Clay refused to renounce anything, and they came to a compromise. And the compromise, he would wait till after the fight to announce this. So in the course of 24 hours, in February 1964, Cassius Clay became heavyweight champion of the world to the shock of the entire sporting world, and the next morning announced to the shock of everyone that he was a new and different man, a member of the Nation of Islam.
Ali told you when you were talking with him that one of his greatest regrets was basically having abandoned Malcolm in favor of Elijah Muhammad.
When I went up to visit Muhammad Ali in Berrien Springs, Michigan, where he lives on a farm, one of the first things he did was take an 8x10 glossy out of his briefcase and show it to me, rather silently, because he doesn't speak that much now, for obvious reasons. And it was a way of showing me that here I am with Malcolm X. The picture was of him and Malcolm X. And it was a very moving way of showing me, you know, he wasn't taking a picture out of Elijah Muhammad or some other fight. It was this relationship that he was deeply proud of. And I think in some ways sorry about, because as you know, after he became champion, Malcolm X went up to New York with Clay, soon to become Ali. They were great friends. They went to the UN. They hung out at the Hotel Teresa in Harlem and all the rest. But then Elijah Muhammad put his foot down and demanded that he choose, the fighter choose, between Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X. And he did. He chose. And he rejected Malcolm X severely and immediately and completely. So much so that on a subsequent trip to Africa some weeks later, they literally, Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali, bumped into each other in a hotel lobby. Malcolm X tried to approach him in the friendliest way possible. And Muhammad Ali simply mocked him, made fun of him. And that was the end of it. And of course, a year later, Malcolm X was gunned down at the Audubon Ballroom uptown in Manhattan.
Ali's showmanship certainly helped sell tickets for his fights. What about his membership in the Nation of Islam? A lot of white people saw the Nation as being an anti-white group and were very alienated by Ali's conversion. How did that affect who showed up at his fights?
Well, at first, it was a great threat. And as you know, in the second Liston fight, first of all, they could barely get a venue. They could barely find a place to fight. There was the threat of the mob. There was also the specter of the Nation of Islam. And a championship fight was held in a small town in Maine in front of just a few thousand people, 3,000-4,000 people. I mean, this is unimaginable. This is when boxing, by the way, was still big. In 1998, perhaps you could believe it, when boxing has kind of faded and become almost vestigial. with the exception of certain fighters, Tyson, Holyfield, and Oscar De La Hoya. And you can be sure that had its effect. And certainly when he refused the draft, this sense of alienation, the sense of division between Ali and his public only deepened. And he
Well, for some people it deepened, and for others, like for you, for instance, it kind of strengthened the connection to him. Because there were so many young people who were alienated.
Later.
That's
but
true. That's true.
Remember,
right.
this is us thinking backward.
Right.
Also, I was a kid at the time.
Right.
Certainly, if you were 19 years old and against the war, you thought this was a pretty amazing thing, that this fighter would step away from the heavyweight championship, quite likely never to fight again, to give up probably tens of millions of dollars, giving up the one thing he could do, fight, because it's not as if he's then going to go off to law school. And you saw this as bravery, enormous bravery, at a time when the anti-war movement was still in its infancy. This was you know, remember, this is early 1967. The level of avoiding the draft was nothing like it would be 2 years later.
You know, I think early on when Ali became a member of the Nation of Islam and then became anti-war, I think some people just saw that as a sign of his eccentricity as opposed to as a sign of his deep commitment to certain beliefs.
You know, what always saved Ali, what always saved him from becoming alienated from certain publics, whether it was the bragging or the politics or the religion, anything, there was always a sense of humor about him. He was always funny, hilarious. And finally, with time, he won over almost everybody. I mean, a few racists here and there, a few people who really felt that his stand on Vietnam was deeply, deeply wrong, a few people that, you know, still yearned for the Joe Lewis model of behavior. Fine. But for the most part, he won over the world so that at the 1996 Olympics, he gets up and lights this torch in the most unexpected, dramatic, and moving and beautiful way. And no one's presence on this globe doing that would have moved us more.
David Remnick's new book about Muhammad Ali is called King of the World. Remnick is the new editor of The New Yorker. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape of the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Bach, an examination of race-sensitive college admissions policies and their long-term consequences. In bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the Clay Liston Prize Fights. We continue our conversation with David Remnick about Muhammad Ali. Also, Ed Ward concludes his series on how country music was influenced by black and white music traditions. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
For those of you who won't be able to see the Clay Liston fight, here's the eighth round exactly as it will happen. Clay comes out to meet Liston, and Liston starts to retreat. If Liston goes back an inch farther, he'll end up in the ringside seat. Clay swings with his left. Clay swings with his right. Look at young Cassius carry the fight. Liston keeps backing, but there's not enough room. It's a matter of time, and Clay lowers the boom. Now Liston disappears from view. The crowd is getting frantic, but our radar stations have picked him up. He is somewhere over the Atlantic.
We're going to continue our talk with David Remnick about his new book, King of the World, which tells the story of Muhammad Ali in the 60s, when he became famous for his rhymes, won the world heavyweight title, joined the Nation of Islam, and abandoned the name Cassius Clay. Let's get to his actual championship fights with Sonny Liston, and you keep coming back to this through the book. Ali almost ended the first championship fight with Liston. Because his eyes were burning so much, he couldn't even see. And I guess there's always been the rumor that Sonny Liston may have juiced his gloves, meaning put some kind of substance on his gloves that would have ended up in Ali's eyes, a chemical of some sort.
My reporting tells me that's beyond rumor, that really was the case.
That it really was the case?
What had happened was he got into the ring. Sonny Liston got into this ring having trained for no more than a 5-round fight. He really thought, in the way Mike Tyson dealing with Michael Spinks or some inferior fighter, that he would dispatch with this loudmouth kid very quickly and go out to dinner. First round happens, and this kid is faster than Sugar Ray Robinson, and he's sticking a jab in his face, and welts are coming up, and he cannot touch him. Liston cannot touch him. He's missing by not 3 inches, but by 2 feet. Round two, same thing. And on it goes. And all that is left to Sonny Liston as he gets more and more tired, as his hands begin to sink to his side. Boxing is an extraordinarily exhausting process, especially if you haven't trained. That he decides to cheat. And with the help of one of his corner men, he puts some substance on his gloves. Now, do we have this from Sonny Liston? No, Sonny's dead. We don't have it from the corner man, Joe Pulino, who's dead. But we have it from a very, very close friend of both Liston and Joe Pulino, Jack McKinney, a reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News at the time and a close friend of both, that he put some substances, whether it was Munsell solution or some sort of liniment, on the gloves, something he had done before, by the way, and he gets it in Clay's eyes. And Clay sits down in the corner and he tells Angelo Dundee, cut off the gloves. I can't see. I'm blind. Cut them off. He wants to quit. It's the one thing that he didn't know how to deal with, being blind. I mean, he knew he was beating Sonny Liston to the punch every single step of the way. And Angelo Dundee quickly gets as much water into his eyes as possible, into his fighter's eyes, and tells him, baby, you ain't quitting. This is for the big one. This is for the title. No quitting now. Just go out, dance, yardstick him, which means keep your left out as far as you can, keep your distance, you have a slight reach thing, you've got the speed, and wait till it flushes out. Meanwhile, in the corner, the black Muslims are sitting there screaming and yelling that Angelo Dundee is a member of the mob, and he's juiced the gloves, that it's Angelo Dundee who's responsible for this, because after all, he has an Italian name, and the mob is still all over boxing at the time. The mob controlled Sonny Liston. So this is the drama going on in the space of 60 seconds. Angelo Dundee somehow convinces the referee not to come over to the corner and end the whole thing. Ali goes back out. Eventually, the stuff washes out of his eyes, and he finishes the job. He continues to frustrate Liston, and Liston finally just will not get off his stool to come out and fight the seventh round. End of story.
So Ali becomes a heavyweight champion there, and then there's a rematch. And the rematch is extraordinary because Ali knocks him out so quickly.
Well, it's a bizarre fight. It's held in Lewiston, Maine, which is, a textile town, a tiny town with, one strip joint and two restaurants and a hotel in Poland Springs, and all the sports writers are whining, and why are we here, and all the rest. And the first it was scheduled for Boston, and Ali had some health problems, and it was delayed. they go into the ring and the atmosphere, everybody's fearing that the Muslims are going to shoot somebody and that the mob is there and that the fix is in and so on and so forth. They come out. Ali does his thing. He's dancing around the ring, dancing around the ring. Liston is struggling to keep up. All of a sudden, Ali turns, pivots, hits Liston with the fastest punch that slow motion has ever recorded. Down goes Liston. The timekeeper loses all sense of how to do his job. The referee is Jersey Joe Walcott, who really, fine fighter, bad referee. Confusion. You know, it was a disaster in terms of organization. End of fight. Probably the most ambiguous and strange heavyweight title fight of all time. At least since the long count of Dempsey long ago.
There were rumors that Liston was actually pressured to fall, you know, that he was pressured to
take a dive.
To take a dive, yeah. Any truth in that, do you think?
I don't think so.
You watched this on slow motion and saw the punch.
I probably watched it as many times as I've seen The Godfather, which is an embarrassing number as well. I probably watched that fight 50 times because it doesn't take too long. It takes an hour to watch it 50 times. And he hit him. He hit him with a perfectly timed, short, overhand right that hit him perfectly on the side of the head. Kaboom. And it's also in the first round when the fighters are cold. That punch probably would not have knocked him out in the seventh round. But in the first round, when two fighters are cold, the likelihood is far greater that it can. And, you know, my feeling is about Sonny Liston and Muhammad Ali, if they fought 10 times, Muhammad would win 9, at least. He beat him.
David Remnick is my guest, and his new book, King of the World, is about Muhammad Ali. David Remnick is the new editor of The New Yorker magazine. You got to talk with Ali in the research for your book. He's had Parkinson's disease for some years now. What's it like to be with him now? How is his health? How able is he to talk?
Well, he talks far more hesitantly. I mean, we all talk far more hesitantly than Muhammad Ali did in the 70s. I mean, this was the great mouth of all time. And yes, there's irony or tragedy or whatever you want to call it in the fact that Parkinson's has robbed Muhammad Ali of what delighted him and us most, which is to say his enormous wit, his kind of verbal sympathy and alacrity. He does speak. You know, he's not very eager to speak in front of television cameras or on the radio. But with somebody he's sitting in a room with and comfortable with, or if he goes to a reception, he's not nearly as loquacious as before. I mean, Parkinson's does this. But he's perfectly happy to talk back and forth. And what I did is I went up to Berrien Springs with a stack of tapes. And most of what we did was watch these fights over a couple of times. And he reacted to them, and I think that delighted him and inspired him to talk more than he might ordinarily do.
You wonder if Ali maybe already had Parkinson's, a very early, mild form of it, before his last fight, and that might have affected him in the ring.
It's unclear. I'm not a doctor. Freddy Pacheco, who was who is a doctor and was in his corner, left his corner because he was deeply concerned that certainly by the time you got to the Larry Holmes fight, something was deeply wrong. It's quite clear that in the best of all possible worlds, at the very latest, Muhammad Ali should have quit the ring after his third fight, the so-called Thrilla in Manila with Joe Frazier in 1975. And he went on too long. And Ferdy Pacheco very wisely said that Muhammad Ali was el único, the unique one, except in the way, and that he was not about boxing. He was about other things. Boxing almost happened to be a component of him. But what was not unique about Muhammad Ali is the arc of his story was like so many great fighters. He went on way too long in an extremely dangerous, morally dubious, probably, enterprise. And the great curse of Muhammad Ali's later career is that he discovered that he could take a punch. When he came back from exile, he realized that he couldn't dance away from everything the way he could as a kid. And so he learned a new way to fight, and part of it was absorbing punishment in the gym, absorbing punishment in the real fight itself. And so, while Muhammad may have won most of these fights in his second career, in almost all of them, he absorbed enormous punishment. And from terrific fighters, Ernie Shavers, George Foreman, Joe Frazier 3 times, Jimmy Young, Larry Holmes, and then from second-rate fighters who began to hit him as well. And this took its enormous toll, and no one can finally decide whether punching or the genetics of neurology conspired in what proportion to lead to the condition he's in now, but clearly fighting had its toll.
My guest is David Remnick, and his new book about Muhammad Ali is called King of the World. I want to change the subject a little bit and talk with you about the New Yorker magazine. You're the new editor of the New Yorker. You succeeded Tina Brown, and I understand that she recommended you as her replacement. Why did you want to be editor of the New Yorker? And I ask you that as someone who really has made his reputation as a writer. And I think editing and writing probably draw on similar but different muscles.
I think mostly different muscles. And I think the enterprise of writing, even if it includes enormous amounts of reporting and being out in the world, is essentially a very solitary, private, and in the best sense, selfish enterprise. You wake up in the morning and you're thinking about my piece of work. You're deeply, if you're any good at all, you're concentrated on this in ways that are extremely annoying to everybody around you. But it's a necessity. I mean, you need some level of concentration day to day, especially if you're sustaining a longish thing. And editing, I'm slowly discovering, or quickly discovering, is in many ways the complete opposite of that, in the sense that you are waking up in the morning with 50 things on your mind, and your primary goal, in many ways, is to get the best work out of someone else. It's at its root, and should be, a more outward and generous way of being. So I can tell you that the adjustment is no small thing.
Well, David Remnick, I want to wish you good luck at The New Yorker.
Thank you so much.
And I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I appreciate it.
David Remnick's new book about Muhammad Ali is called King of the World. Remnick is the new editor of The New Yorker. Coming up, Ed Ward concludes his series on black and white influences on country music. This is Fresh Air. Although it may be pretty easy to say that a given musician belongs to one race or another, it's not so easy to say that about the music he or she might play. In the second part of a 2-part series, Ed Ward shows how radio furthered a musical mix that gave birth to some of the most popular music of the post-war era.
Lee Ford Bailey, and it'll be his famous Fox Chase. All right, Lee Ford.
For many years, the first sounds a listener tuning into the Grand Ole Opry heard were the voice of George Hay, the announcer, and the music of DeFord Bailey, a black harmonica player. The Opry was a phenomenon. Each week it broadcast on a clear channel radio station that could be heard all over the South and drew innumerable listeners to its patented mix of country music and corny humor. Which explains this.
Love that runs away from me. Dreams that just won't let me be. Blues that keeps on bothering me. chains that just won't set me free. Too far.
And this.
Your cheating whore will make you weep. Sleep won't come.
And this.
Want you, baby, from time to time, but you just won't listen. Now, pay me no mind, so I'm moving on.
He's moving on.
I'm rolling on.
Roll on, roll on.
You've broken your vow, and it's all over now, so I'm moving on.
Moving on.
That big eight wheeler rolling down the track. Need your true love, and daddy ain't coming back, cause I'm moving on.
He's moving on.
I'm rolling on.
Roll on, roll on.
You're flying too high from mountain to the sky, so I'm moving on.
At first, it seems paradoxical that Solomon Burke, Fats Domino, and Ray Charles would be singing songs recorded by Farron Young, Hank Williams, and Hank Snow. But the Opry is the explanation. The radio was the first mass entertainment medium, and at first it featured nothing but live musicians. Even when radio started playing records, hillbilly and black music weren't part of the mix, and there was no black equivalent to the Opry. But the radio was free. All over the South, neighbors gathered to enjoy the weekly Opry broadcasts, and some of them were black. The fact that there was no black Opry meant that white fans of rural black music had a much harder time finding what they were interested in. Few blues fans dared the Southside clubs in Chicago, where Muddy Waters held forth, or the strip of clubs on Memphis's Beale Street. Some, of course, did.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama, just any way you do. That's all right, that's all right. That's all right, Mama, any way you do. Well, Mama, she done told me.
In the South, they were called cats, people like Elvis Presley and his friends, whose enthusiasm and respect earned them entree to the Beale Street scene. In the North, they were the kids who listened to Alan Freed's pioneering rhythm and blues show in Cleveland and went to his mixed dances. But as rock and roll gathered momentum, so did the American folk revival with its blinkered sense of the black tradition, which denied that Chuck Berry, for instance, was a blues artist. It took the Rolling Stones and their heirs to remind Americans that Chicago blues existed, and by then it was almost too late. It was in Memphis that another cross-pollination began to happen 5 years after Elvis burst on the scene. Stax Records was run by a former country fiddle champion, Jim Stewart, and his sister, Estelle Axton. And at the heart of the label's inimitable sound was the house band, Booker T and the MGs, two white guys and two black guys who made impeccable soul music, a genre the label virtually invented. In fact, soul, for all that it symbolized black pride in its heyday in the 1960s, was, at least in the studio, a completely integrated music. The singers may have been black, but at least in the South, the bands weren't.
Chain, chain, chain,
chain, chain, chain,
chain, chain,
chain,
chain,
chain,
chain,
chain,
chain,
chain,
chain, chain,
chain,
chain,
chain,
chain,
chain,
chain, chain,
chain,
chain,
chain,
chain,
Aretha Franklin's Chain of Fools is a perfect example. The songwriter was black, one of the guitarists, Joe South, was white, the piano player was too, and even one of the backup vocalists was Ellie Greenwich, a nice Jewish girl from the Brill Building. And that piano player, Spooner Oldham, wrote songs with another white guy, Dan Penn, that are among the most soulful ever.
At the dark end of the street, that's where we always meet, hiding in shadow where we don't. living in darkness to hide our wrong. You and me had the dark end of the street. You and me. I know times.
But Charlie Pride notwithstanding, country music didn't really return the favor, and by the early 1970s, the music world was segregating again. It would take at least another decade before rap began to draw the strands together for yet another fusion.
Ed Ward currently lives in Berlin.
Coming up, a blues tribute to John Glenn. This is Fresh Air.
Tomorrow's the big day for John Glenn. His first orbital spaceflight in 1962 inspired many tributes, including a song written and performed by the great blues singer and guitarist Lightnin' Hopkins. Hopkins watched that first flight on his landlady's TV soon after he was due at the recording studio, where he decided to write a song about Glenn. The first take of his moody song was interrupted by a technical problem. As the repairs were being made, he read an article about John Glenn, and by the time Hopkins did the next take, he had changed the melody and the mood of the song. It had become happy blues for John Glenn. Here's that recording.
People always said this morning with this on their mind. Said ain't no living man can go around the world three times, but John Glenn done it. Yes, he did it. He did it, I'm talking about it. Only did it for fun. $500,000 made him feel so well. He got to eating lunch and couldn't hardly tell. He said, I feel all right. John Glenn said it. Everybody was laughing. and they didn't regret it. It was a minute prayer went up, praying that he would land. I looked at a schoolhouse full of them and they didn't know what to say. But they said, let him come back, God. Please let him land. You know that's the only man ever did it, and you with a helping hand. I'm gonna turn out to be one. But I didn't see him when he land. But I know he was doing all right when he says okay to give him a great big hand. He'll be in on the next year. This is on the his mother said, I know my son's gonna make it. It ain't never been no mistake. Something. This ain't lying. You know that man must have on his mind flying. It ain't nobody will take that much time unless they gon' build them homestead airplane and they gon' go fly. They told him, don't worry, this is true. You may miss me for a few minutes, but I'll be back to see about you. He did. Yes, he did. Yes, when he done it, they didn't know who he was in the helicopter. Body, they even test his heart. They know he was all right when he was in the start. I mean, he made it. He went around the world 3 times. You know, he went and got him an airplane and he made up and he had it on his mind.
Lightnin' Hopkins recorded just after John Glenn's first space flight in 1962. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown and Company, publisher of The Thinker's Way, 8 Steps to a Richer Life by John Chaffee, Ph.D., in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.